Archer the editor away in North West London, extended programme Thursday. Thursday, Hanukkah, Kof Hei Kislev, 26th of December. Rena Rav, Dayan, Benimelech, Vendetta, Shlita.
DNA in
Halacha. This week's Torah has been sponsored by Stolz Refuah, Shlem, Lechol, Kali, Yisrael, and his first Ashram, Malachayram, and Ramash, Yatsul, Shalom, Ben Jirov.
Good morning, my dear friends. Good morning, it's lovely to be here, lovely to be back. Frelichen Chanukah, Lichtige Chanukah. May the light of Chanukah, Be'ez Hashem, bring freedom to all the hostages and may they be reunited with their families immediately with no further delay. We're going to be talking today in a very summarized manner. We're going to be talking about the topic of DNA in Halacha. And you may ask, what is the connection between DNA in Halacha and Chanukah? We should be talking about Inyanei Chanukah. Well, I will say that this is Inyanei Deyoma, because one of the things that we say, and one of the things that we commemorate, is the fact that we were able to vanquish those who wanted to forbid us. They wanted to prevent us from studying Torah. Lashkicham Torosecha. They wanted us to forget Torah. But it is fascinating because Chazal explained to us that they didn't necessarily want to prevent us from studying Torah. They would let us study Torah as long as we studied Torah as a science and not as Divrei Elohim Chaim. If we divorce Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam and we study Torah as a science, then it's okay. It's not a problem. So this question about the intersection between Torah and science is very often asked, and there are those who want to corroborate Torah with science, and that, if I may say, is a treifen machshava, because Torah doesn't need to be corroborated by science. We know that Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the Torah, and it doesn't need, you know, scientific evidence to... No, we know, this is a reality. But we need to understand where the intersections between Torah and science lie nowadays. We are living an era of unprecedented scientific breakthroughs. And I want to go over this sugya with you from the perspective of Torah, so that we can understand what is the applicability of DNA testing currently in the Olam HaTorah, in our world, when, where, how, and if there is any acceptance, if it is admissible, in Beis Din, for example, so on and so forth. So it is very much Inyan HaDeyoma. Now, DNA in Halacha will intersect with Halacha in basically three specific areas. One of them is to determine paternity or maternity. The other one is to determine identity. And the other one, which is the latest addition to this reality, is to determine Jewishness. So, the three questions that we're going to be looking over are: is DNA testing admissible if one is trying to establish paternity or maternity? The second one: is DNA testing admissible if we are trying to establish someone's identity? For example, if a husband goes missing and we need to deal with the case of an aguna. And the third one is, can we rely on DNA testing to establish whether or not someone is halachically Jewish? Now, for the sake of brevity, you will allow me to skip over. I'm going to glance over many of the sources without going in detail. If you are interested, I can please let me know. Josh has my contact details. Please do let me know, and I'll be more than happy to send you the whole list of my requirements, so you can go over. Okay. The precursor to DNA testing, which came about around 100 years ago, is blood testing for the sake of establishing paternity. And we have Dr. Harris over here, who may be able to assist me with further scientific information over here. But over 100 years ago, we didn't have DNA testing, so if paternity had to be established, they did blood testing to compare if the blood type of the child coincides with the blood type of the parents, so on and so forth. That question came to the then Rishon Lezion, Rav Uziel. And he was asked to rule on this matter whether or not blood testing is halachically acceptable. And he rules that it is not admissible and it is not acceptable. And he brings a proof from the Gemara Maseches Nida. The Gemara Maseches Nida on Daf Lamed. The Gemara tells us there are, very famous Gemara, there are three shutofim, three partners in the creation of a human being. And the three partners are the mother, the father, and the Ribbono Shel Olam. Exactly. And the Gemara tells us that red material, our red material, is given to us by the mother. Is given to us by the mother. That's what the Gemara says. So says Rav Uziel, if the red and blood is what? Blood is our red material, so it comes from the mother. If it comes from the mother, then it is inadmissible and one can't use blood testing to establish paternity because it doesn't coincide with the Gemara. And if Chazal gave us a very unequivocal directive saying that red material comes from the mother, that is the established reality, and that is the way it goes. And this happens to be the majority opinion. The majority opinion, surprisingly, the Tzitz Eliezer, who wrote extensively, he was the Rav of Shari Tzedek, he had extensive medical knowledge, for example, and he came later. He agrees with Rav Uziel, and he passes that blood testing would not be admissible for the sake of establishing paternity, as does Rav Ovadia. And so we have over here, that constitutes the majority opinion. And the majority of poskim will follow Rav Uziel's opinion and will say blood testing is not admissible. I'll come to that. So they say, the vast majority say it is not admissible. Why? Because that is what the Gemara says. And we can't go against Chazal. His counterpart at the time, Rav Uziel's counterpart, was Rav Herzog, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi. He came in later, but they coincided for a tkufa. And Rav Herzog was a very pragmatic man, and he writes in Asiyah number 35, he writes that coming to this conclusion is akin, is the equivalent of burying our head in the sand. Why? Because science shows us empirical scientific evidence nowadays shows us that that is not necessarily true. And there is a debate. There is a debate amongst the Rishonim. The Rambam writes in Moreh Nevuchim, for example, if medical details that we find in Chazal and in the Gemara, if they have the same weight as the rest of the Gemara, or if they're just a codification of what the scientific knowledge was at the time of the Gemara. So we have this machloikas rishonim. The Rambam Moreh Nevuchim says that medical evidence and medical information found in Chazal is not halacha l'moshe Sinai. It reflects their scientific knowledge at the time. Now, one of the reasons as to why, surprisingly, this will serve to strengthen the Tzitz Eliezer's argument, because the Tzitz Eliezer says, science is, you know, what was true in science 100 years ago was not true today. Whereas what was true in Torah 1,000 years ago is true today. And therefore, says the Tzitz Eliezer, how can we now all of a sudden say this is the latest piece of information if it will be disproven, you know, 50 years from now, and the new theory will surface, and that will become a different reality. But we have this machloikas amongst the poskim of 100 years ago, and the majority opinion will follow Rav Uziel's psak, saying that blood testing is not admissible, but there is a minority. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he agrees with Rav Herzog, and Rav Shlomo Zalman says, we should be reading this Gemara literally, saying that all red material, maybe that's the catalyst, maybe red material in terms of being the catalyst to the formation of blood, but not to the entirety of every single blood cell in a person's body will necessarily come exclusively from the mother. So we see over here, we have a machlokes. However, if we go back in time, the Sefer Hasidim in 232 will tell us a story about a master who was traveling, a very wealthy master who was traveling with his expecting wife and his eved and his servant, and they were traveling, and this master passes away. He dies. And there is an expecting wife with an unborn child and the slave. And the slave was an abyssal oberchochem, so he goes back to that man's normal place of abode, and he claims the inheritance as being the deceased person's only child. And they give him the inheritance. And then the child is born, and he grows up, and he says, I have a taina against this person, because he's not the son, I am the son. I never met my father, but I am the son, he was the slave. So they come to Rav Haigaon. And Rav Haigaon paskens that the body of the deceased should be exhumed. They dig up the body of the deceased. Rav Haigaon removes a bone from the deceased and removes blood from the slave and blood from the child. He puts the blood in two different containers and he sticks the blood sticks the bone into one container of blood and into the other container of blood. And lo and behold, the blood absorbs, the bone absorbs the blood of the son. And therefore, says Rav Haigaon, you are an imposter and you claimed an inheritance that was not rightfully yours and you are the son. And he awards the inheritance to the son. So we have a precedent over here. We have a precedent over here where some form of blood testing was used to determine paternity. How can that be? Now contrast this with the Gemara in Maseches Baba Basra on Daf Nun Ches. There's a very famous Gemara in Maseches Baba Basra on Daf Nun Ches in which a man on his deathbed, a man who is the father of 10 children, on his deathbed, he says the following, he makes the following statement. I have 10 children, and only one of them is really my child, and the other 9 are not my children. And I am leaving my inheritance to the one who is my child. Now, Baruch Hashem, that Shiloh has never come to Beis Din. Because how does one deal with that Shiloh? So the Shiloh came to Rav Binah.
Did he specify who the child was?
No. No, he didn't specify who the child was. He says, I have 10, only one of them is really my child, and I'm leaving my inheritance to that child. So the man passed on without revealing who is the child. And so the Shiloh came to Rav Binah. And Rav Binah passes as follows. You know what he did? Now you're going to remember this, Gemara. Rav Binah says, okay, not a problem at all. We're going to take a big stick, and every single one of you will go to the matseva, and you will hit the matseva, and you will tell the nifter, I'm not going to stop hitting until you tell me who is the child. So child number one takes the stick, starts hitting the matseva. No answer. Child number two, and then one child, one son, says the following. I'm not interested in the inheritance, but I will not hit my father's matseva. Rav Binah says, here's the son. Here's the son. Why? Here's the son. Because a son will not hit his father's matseva. A son will not desecrate his father's memory in this manner. So we see over here. Now the Rashbam commenting on this Gemara, explains that this is a case of Shuda the Diner. Shuda the Diner, exactly as was mentioned over here, it is a Solomonic decision. The Rashash, commenting on the Rashbam, asks, one second, why didn't they do the same blood testing? Why didn't they dig up the person, remove the bone, remove blood from every single one of the 10 children, stuck the bone into the blood? Do you see? Why didn't they, if Rav Haigon did it, why didn't they do it? You know what's the explanation? You know what's the reason? Says the Rosh Hashanah. Because by applying Shuda the Diner, you're simply showing that one child is more roi, is more appropriate to be the father's heir. But you're not saying that the other nine are Monzeri. Because they live their lives becheskas kashrus. If you do the blood testing by Rav Haigon, one of them was clearly not a child, was the Eved, and the other one was the child. But you're not proving that anyone is a mamzer. In this situation, if you do the blood testing, you prove unequivocally that 10 of them were brought up becheskas kashrus. And now on his deathbed, the father says, only one of them is really my child. So says the Rosh Hashanah, explaining that in this, by applying this and not reverting or to a blood testing, you can prove that one of them was more appropriate as the heir, but you're not discrediting the kashrus of the other nine. There was a case in 1977 of mistaken babies at an Israeli hospital. And the question came to Rav Ovadia and to other poskim at the time. And they said, now, reliability of DNA testing back then was not what it is now. It was lower. And they paskened that DNA testing should be administered to identify who are the parents of the baby. How can we reconcile this and that? But DNA should be taken from the mother, not from the father. Because by establishing who is the mother, you identify the family of the specific mistaken baby without calling into question whether or not the baby is kosher or a mamzer, so on and so forth. And all of this, if you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch, if you take a look at Shulchan Aruch in Ebenezer, all of the things that we're talking about over here are in Ebenezer, in Siman Dalet. If you take a look in Siman Dalet, and you go to Alocha Chof Ches, Alocha Chof Ches will give us the parameters. Alocha Chof Ches will give us the parameters of kashrus over here. It says the Ramah says, V'had the Avnei Man al Benoi, Aynu Davka Sheloi Aloi Cheskas Kashrus. When is a father Neeman, when is a father trustworthy, relied upon to say that this is not my child? When there was no Cheskas Kashrus. A father can't, 10 years later, father has been bringing up this child as his own child, 10 years later he says, not my child. Father can't be poisel, the child. There was a Cheskas Kashrus that was enjoyed over here. So the vast consensus, amongst Boti Din, when it comes to DNA testing for the sake of establishing paternity, is that it is not allowed. It is not allowed. Now, I give you the example. To establish maternity in the case of the mistaken babies, it was allowed. DNA testing, in terms of identifying identity, of establishing identity, came to the forefront of the halachic discussion after the tragedy at the Twin Towers, 9/11, when many Eden lost their lives, lo aleinu. In a way, it is also being applied now in identifying the remains of victims of the 7th of October, because here we have an issue of agunis. Well, women who are waiting for the husbands, and the husbands are not coming back, unfortunately. They're not coming back.
And the terrorists. And identified
Yeah. Yeah, but the terrorists, I'm not interested in their agunis. But, and in this situation, there is a big discussion if we can come up with new simonim. Can we come up with new simonim to identify a person, and especially a simon that is not nikar ba'ayin? You know, there is a whole discussion, it's not our topic, but there is a whole discussion if bedikas toilain, for example, is only what you can see, what is visible to the naked eye, or if we take an ultra-incredible electronic microscope that magnifies things a million times and we see a tiny bug. Rav Osher Weiss was in London last week, I missed him, and he made a very powerful statement lately about bedikas toilain. He says, if it's not nikar ba'ayin, it's not. Loi nidna toira lemalach yasharis. Yeah, so, but that's a separate point. But this is used in the analysis of whether we can rely on DNA is not visible to the naked eye. So can we come up with new simonim? And there is a long discussion, be'arichus, as I mentioned, I need to be mekatzer. This is a fascinating topic, but I need to be mekatzer. And there is a long discussion as to whether or not DNA would be admissible to establish identity. And the bottom line conclusion of the poskim is that it is admissible. It is admissible. If we're dealing with an issue of an aguna who is waiting for a husband who may not be coming back, and we have DNA, and we can do DNA testing to see if the remains of the missing husband have been found, we allow DNA testing, and we will rely on the results to free up this aguna. Our rabbi said, yes, sir.
So I seem to remember from a previous year on this topic, it's something like DNA can be 1 in 10,000, could be, you know, the same, or something like that. So
as I mentioned, in the early 90s, the reliability of DNA was approximately 99.6. So there was a 0.04 margin of error, whereas over here, right now it is higher, but still, you know, the same with fingerprints, so on and so forth. There may be a distant possibility that, you know, we could find a match. So however,
the found the people. Why do you need DNA? You recognize them as people?
No. Sometimes, unfortunately, you only find fragments of a person. If the person, unfortunately, is the victim of an explosion, you only find fragments of a person. So in this situation, DNA is admissible. Why is it admissible? What is the difference? Manishtana DNA is there from the other DNA. You know what's the difference? You know the famous Mishnah Maseches Eduyos, Perek Ches, Mishnah Zayin. Mishnah says that we have no business going around Klal Yisrael being megale problems, uncovering problems, uncovering mamze. We have no business casting aspersions on anyone's cheskas kashrus. So doing a DNA test in that situation would put the individual in a disadvantageous position, would put the individual in a... It would create problems, and we have no right to create problems where no problems exist. However, if it comes to giving someone a schus, if it comes to saving someone, saving an aguna from remaining an aguna forever, since we're helping, then we do allow DNA in that situation. So we allow DNA for the sake of helping someone, not for the sake of complicating, you know. And I gave you the example of the maternity, of the establishing the identity of who, you know, this baby, who does, because that is a schus for the person. Finding you belong to this family, these are your parents, and those are your parents. And so the same over here. DNA testing for creating a problem is not allowed. Normally. And in all circumstances. I'm not saying in exceptional cases. Again, you know, Baruch Hashem, I've been coming here for many, many, many years. And I always say in most, if not all of my shiurim, that I'm not passing any halacha lemaisa. We are talking in learning. For halacha lemaisa, you ask your respective poskim. So for paternity, it is not allowed. For establishing identity and freeing up an aguna, for example, it is allowed.
That means that the other way around, if somebody's cheska, let's say a mamzer, in order to get him out of the cheska's mamzer, it would be allowed. machshir him?
That's a very good question. That is a very good, because he's already Becheskas Mamzerus. That's a very good question. Very good question. I would, again, double, you know, sort of doubling up on what I said, not passing a local emaisa, but I think there might be a case to say that, because that might be a suitable person. There's only one thing that is actually worse than a Mamzer, halachically a Sophic Mamzer. Yeah, because a Sophic Mamzer, he can't marry anyone. He's in a worse situation. Yeah? That's why Ein Simchat Keter as a Sfeikis. Yeah? Now, DNA testing for the sake of establishing Jewishness. A number of years ago, around 10, maybe not more than 15 years ago, someone in Israel came up. There are five studies, five academic papers from different universities around the world, universities in Israel, universities in Europe, so on and so forth, studying the topic of whether there is a distinctive marker, specifically in Ashkenazi Jews, and we have many specific markers, but there is something called mitochondrial DNA, mDNA. Mitochondrial DNA is passed by the mother, and she got it from her mother. It is matrilineal, mitochondrial DNA. So there is a theory advanced by a scientist called Professor Da Costa and Professor Soretsky. These two professors, they came up with a theory that over 50% of Ashkenazi Jews are descendants of four original Imois. And I'm not talking about Sarah Rivka, Rachel Velea. Okay, four Ashkenazi women in Central Europe, and over half of all Ashkenazim descend from those women, and therefore, in a situation where a person doesn't have any evidence to back up his or her claim of being Jewish, there you can do a mitochondrial DNA testing on this person, and depending on the result, if those markers are found, then the person was a Goy Gomor yesterday. And then you do DNA testing, it's absolutely not a problem at all. Now you're here, I see the marker is here, and now you're Jewish. There is a tribe in Africa, the Lemba tribe in Africa, by Mozambique and South Africa. The Lemba tribe, 98% of them carry a distinctive marker that is found in Koyanim. What does that mean? Does that mean that they are Koyanim? They can come here to Oil Moshe, Yom Tov, and give Birkas Koyanim? I don't know. So, in this situation, there is a machon in Eretz Yisrael. It's a machon in Eretz Yisrael, and the whole raison d'etre of this machon is to do mitochondrial DNA testing to ascertain people's Jewishness. And this is very prevalent, not necessarily in our circles, but this is very prevalent when it comes to people coming out of the former Soviet Union states, where many documents can't be relied upon because there were many forgeries, so on and so forth. Now, let me tell you what some of the problems are. Some of the problems are as follows. As I mentioned, there are five papers. One of them, Professor Da Costa and Soretsky, says that 50% of Ashkenazi Jewry descend from four Ashkenazi ladies a while ago, and the markers are very clear, 16% this and 20-something percent that, so on and so forth. But you have four other papers, including one by Professor Tofanelli, saying that this is rubbish, that you can statistically, if you play with statistics, you can arrive at the same result irrespective of the population that you are studying. Now, there is something else. For the statistical progression to materialize, for the statistical reality to pan out from four ladies until half of the Ashkenazi Jewish population nowadays, how many years do you think should have passed from the beginning until now? How many years? It is there in the study that it is between 16,000 and 21,000 years. I think that leaves us with a bit of a theological problem. Of course, if you want to say we can reconcile with billions of years, then you belong to a different base medrash, not to this base medrash, and the reality will be very different. So no leading poisek has come out today. As of now, no leading poisek, not Rav Osher Wise, no leading poisek has come out today unequivocally saying that mitochondrial DNA can be single-handedly relied upon to establish Jewishness. It doesn't go. And that has been published, I'm not saying only in Haredi, but the Midrash is, Tchumim published a paper saying it can't, Asya published a paper saying it can't, but there is an institute in Eretz as well, and that is what they believe, and that's what they advocate, and that's their reality. Rav Zalman Chaime Zatzal was matir as a tziruf. If you have everything else and you only have a missing link, then as a tziruf, he would allow it, but not milechatchila. And therefore, to summarize, when it comes to paternity, consensus is that it is not allowed, not admissible. When it comes to establishing identity for the sake of freeing up an aguna, or indeed identifying the remains so that the person can be buried by his family or her family, whatever, it is allowed because that's a schus. And when it comes to establishing Jewish identity, cheskas yadus, it is the consensus of vast majority of bot 18 nowadays is not to rely upon that as a reality. Thank you so much. I wish you a liftig of Chanukah, and I'm very happy to see and hand over to Rav Rudin, who is a dear friend, a distinguished colleague, and a leading Talmud Chacham.
I was hoping you wouldn't stop. I was enjoying myself so much.
How are you?